There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1109, August 25th, 2025, and before we go to Steve on today's program, we have another special summer break feature, our final one. The host and Nasser Hamid talk about McLaren and team orders. And this is back in 2007, and it was Monaco. Very exciting, and we were pumped up. You could imagine Nasser fighting for LCH tooth and nails. And this week's interviews, we've got Jan Magnussen and one of our favorite podium finishers, 2005 United States Grand Prix, Thiago Montero. Of course, the best finish of his entire career, next to the winner, Michael Schumacher. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know, you want to. Steve?
This F1 Weekly podcast brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads bring you the F1Weekly.com web server, the ads that interest you. From Ferrari jackets to Renault hats, Yahoo Ads get you the stuff you really want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Yahoo, and thank you, Stephen. Keep up the good work. There you have it. And a quick reminder to all the listeners on today's show, we have an interview with Jan Magnussen, a former Formula One driver, sports car driver, wonderful guy. NAS does it again and hits a home run. So there you have it. And, of course, we've got to get into this right away. I brought NAS into the studio because this hoopla, this brouhaha about Ron Dennis, and you know what? Maybe you were right, Steve, a couple of weeks ago, saying that Ron Dennis was German. He certainly looked German on the podium. His organizational skills certainly sound German. And I've got to get NASA's impression on this, of course, because what is going on? Team orders are, you know, every time they rear their head, everybody's freaked out. Like it's something new. This has been going on for years, years, and years, and years. It's called logic. It's a team. You have to manage the team during the race, especially when you have engines that have to last two races. You want to make sure your cars are not going to wind up in the barrier. You need the points to win a world championship.
You have a rookie driver who has already kissed the Armco a couple times during the race. You don't want him to get even more involved and basically tear off an entire tire like Kimi did in qualifying.
Yeah, that's not
makes perfect sense. You know, and it's not that he basically told Lewis to let Fernando pass him to win the race, as in the whole thing that really made team orders illegal back in 2002. He's basically conserving his cars for the next race, basically ensuring his position in the race. The positions really weren't going to change. There was maybe a small possibility that Lewis could have gotten past Fernando, but why take the risk?
I think Fernando had the race in control. He was not kissing the Armcos at all while Lewis was. Lewis made a mistake in practice and messed up the front end of his car. Fernando really was it was a cleaner race. It was a controlled race. I think Fernando had this in the bag, whether they cut the umbilical cord, so to speak, and let Lewis go like a bat out of hell. Nasser, your opinion on this whole situation?
Well, I think that there will be races this year where Lewis Hamilton will pass Alonso and other drivers fair and square. That's expected, and it's going to happen. But to expect him to try to pass Alonso or any two drivers in a competitive car at Monaco of all the places, we're asking for Suzuka, Alain Prost, and Ayrton Senna. You know what I mean? I mean, there's just no room to pass that if the cars are equally competitive. You know, it's not like one guy is in a Minardi, the other guy is like in a Renault of 2005. That will get you going.
No, but I remember some of the Senna Prost accidents at the beginning of the race or during the race where, you know, all those points were lost because of stupidity, bad management. You learn from those mistakes, and Ron Dennis is not going to let this championship get away by any stretch of the imagination.
Or he's not going to give it up a stupid move by letting his drivers take each other out.
And somebody posted on the forum, you know, that Ron Dennis should have smiled, you know, both guys dominated the race. And I was wondering, then maybe the answer is no. Do you think he's missing Kimi Raikkonen?
I don't think so. No, as a matter of fact, he's probably giggling deep inside about that whole situation. And since you brought it up, Nass, what is up with your lover boy?
Who would that be?
Kimi.
Kimi who?
Kim's
well, I'll tell you what. He is ever so gingerly and tenderly kissing this world championship goodbye. Because problem now is with first and second, the spread is only 2 points. Okay. And I still think Ferrari has a stronger package in terms of speed on, you know, high speed track. Thank you, Yahoo Ads. But when they go to Montreal, which is pretty much like a street course, I have a hunch that McLaren will again dominate. And if Alonso wins again and Raikkonen finishes third or fourth, he's going to go down 19, 20 points to Fernando. And then the party will be over. And all he has to do is check with his predecessor how hard it is to make up 20 points.
Exactly. And it's interesting that you mention McLaren possibly and probably will dominate at Circuit Gilles Villeneuve. And this is bringing me back to last year, Renault having a great beginning of the year, do well in Canada, and all of a sudden, we see Schumacher doing his famous jump on the podium at Indianapolis.
And many other places.
And many other places after that. So we could have a similar situation here.
But, you know, it's very possible. But, you know, it's not over for Kimi or Massa or Hamilton. Especially when it comes to Kimi Raikkonen and Alonso, these two guys are very capable of winning 3-4 races in a row. So it's possible that Kimi can have a good run, and all it takes is one DNF from Alonso, where he will be back in the game. So, you know, we still have about like 70% of the races to go, but Kimi Raikkonen has made his job very tough now.
And McLaren's due. They have, I don't think they've had a retirement yet this season. And
it's I'm not going to say it, Steve, because you know what happens when I say that. No, it happens.
But we talked about this is what happened last season, is the odds –
the numbers
slowly begin to creep up on us, you know, whether it be someone taking them out, somebody making a dumb move on a start, or just something odd happening.
This is why I think you're not. This is not going to happen, Stephen, because McLaren had so many retirements last year.
They've got a whole bunch.
It's going to take years. They got the karma going on their side now, so everything is cool there. But we'll see what's going to happen. I think Canada is going to be a great race, and this could be the race that ends McLaren's, because once they get to Indianapolis, Ferrari, we know they dominated Indianapolis.
Yes. And you know, there was a lot of talk of Steinmetz diamonds at the Monaco race.
Oh, yes.
So I'm calling Kimi now Ferrari's $51 million rough diamond, you know.
Yeah. I wonder how I think they're still keeping a stiff upper lip over at Ferrari, but they are disappointed. But I think they want to work with Kimi. You know, let's not forget, Kimi was used to Michelin tires. They still are not getting this car set up the way Kimi likes it. He is still not a happy guy behind the wheel like a Felipe Massa, who's extremely comfortable. That car is set up for Felipe like you wouldn't believe. So, you know, let's cut some slack on Kimi's side. And give him a little while to still, because getting acclimated to Ferrari is no easy task.
No, I think Ferrari went into Monaco knowing that they were going to have a challenge being competitive because of their longer wheelbase on a short, tight track like Monaco is. That's a disadvantage big time. And I think they would have been a lot happier if Kimi could have, you know, not knocked himself out in qualifying and basically if they finished a 3-4 instead of a 3-8. They would have been a lot happier, but they figured they probably would have challenges winning here.
Okay, let's move on. Scott Speed, all of a sudden, the rainbow was shining over his little area in the paddock. Did a really good job, I think. If he didn't have that tire blowout in Spain, he would have had a fairly good race. He passed a lot of cars at the beginning of that race. That seems to be his new mantra. He passes a lot of cars at the beginning of the race. What do you guys think?
He slowly works his way up the field. He seems to be doing quite well being competitive midfield. He seems to be out driving a lot of the other midfielders, and they've been giving him a better car the last couple of weeks. See if he can carry it on through. Let's hope that we get to see him race the entire race in Indianapolis and not get taken out in the first corner like last year. But he's basically going from goat to king at Toro Rosso, because Vitantonio really has been competitive, but Scott seems to be outpacing him relatively consistently.
And making less mistakes. Now, let's not forget that there was a small incident between David Coulthard and Vitantonio Liuzzi. Liuzzi.
Are you trying to teach him something here?
I'm trying
to. That's why I said Vitantonio.
Liuzzi. And that could have damaged Liuzzi's car. So we're not sure if he made a mistake and hit the wall, or Scott Speed is just, things happen in waves in Formula One. And Scott Speed certainly, he's on the tidal wave right now. He's looking fantastic, but he's being smart. It's time to perform, Scott. You're going to North America. If he could pull out another good race, that it's going to guarantee a 2008 seat.
If he could turn around and get a point at Indy like his teammate did last year, that would be a big feather in his cap.
You know, personally, I'm not very sold on his teammate, Liuzzi Vitantonio. But I'm surprised how so many people, I'm talking about heavy-duty industry insiders, they think the world of this guy. I mean, I know he won the Karting World Championship and he dominated the Formula 3000 last year. I think he won the year Michael Schumacher won the first seven races. He did the same thing in that series. He was totally dominant. But he really has, if he was that good, he should have blown away Scott Speed. And he has not done that. So this is Scott Speed's one last chance to really, we have like 17 races this year. I think if he can out-qualify Liuzzi in 10 races and finish at least half of them running at the end, he has a very good chance of staying in the Formula One pool, you know.
Exactly. And we would like to keep an American in Formula One. I think it would do the sport some good. Attendance at Indy, if he improves and gets up the grid and gets in a few points paying positions, that could really start a snowball effect in terms of fan base. And that's what we need, is fan base in the United States for Formula One.
And he's an everyday kind of guy, you know. I mean, we met his folks.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not some, you know, Marco Andretti or some, you know, high
roller. No, he certainly wasn't born with a spoon in his mouth.
Yeah, and he has worked his way up, and, you know, I don't know, you know, he had some medical issue.
I don't know the exact.
Yeah, so he has worked hard, and, one of us made it in the big series, you know.
Exactly.
An everyday kind of guy. So it will be a good, you know, this is just like, you know, I was talking to one German guy one day about why nobody likes, among the people I have spoken to, Schumacher in Germany. And he said, you know, the problem is when Boris Becker was successful in Germany, in the world in tennis, he said people could feel a connection to him that he was one of us. But he said Schumacher was so aloof, right or wrong, I don't know. But, you know, you don't get that with Scott Speed, even though I have not been able to talk to him or you for that matter. But you don't feel that this is that kind of a character. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, let's move on to another great performance, I thought, especially at the beginning of the race. And that was Keke's boy,
Nico.
Nico.
He had a good race going until his car kind of gave up on him.
Exactly. And more bad luck for him. But he's feeling more comfortable. I think he's feeling more comfortable in the car and putting in good laps, not making the mistakes we've seen him make last year.
Yeah, definitely. He seems to be a little bit more consistent. I think in Monaco it helps because his old man's around. I think that kind of gives him a little extra confidence that he's racing in front of his dad. So he wants to perform better. It's like any athlete, you know, playing in front of your parents always is a little boost.
It's papito.
Exactly. And so I think that's helped him. He has been more consistent this season. And his teammate is he's more the number one now. And I think he feels that responsibility to perform better, and that's helping his
performance. And speaking of his teammate, Mr. Wurst actually had a pretty good race as well.
Who?
Wurst. I'm trying to get all these pronunciations. I mean, I'm getting
– Wurst.
I'm getting a – it's Wurst?
Think of it as W-U-R-T-Z.
Right. Yeah, but in German, the W is Wurst.
But you don't even pronounce the T, which is not W. It's, you know, that's okay. How it should be pronounced.
It's hopeless, isn't it?
No, I think there is still some hope. Okay, not a whole lot, but there is some.
Okay, excellent, excellent. So Williams did well. One more person before we go to break I have to bring up because he's my favorite. Half Schumacher, Toyota, abysmal, a complete mess.
And you know, I love the fact that the president of Toyota came out and went, we're in the driver pool.
Yeah. Gee, what a surprise. Yeah. You know what I was thinking? Not that they need this help right now. Scott Speed would be a very good replacement for
Ralph.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, he's an American guy in a Toyota. It'll be, you know, and they can really promote him here. You know, they do a lot of advertising. They can use his face in that advertising.
That's
what it will take. And they have a pretty decent driver in Trulli who has a lot of experience. They just don't have a winning package right now. And, you know, once they get this car going up to speed, and if Speed and Trulli are not performing, then they can give them free Toyota Highlander and tell them to, you know, take a hike.
Very good. I like that. Scott Speed at Toyota promoting Toyotas because Toyota's big here.
Well, see, how any sports get big, you know, NFL is one very good example. I'm not a big NFL guy, but I was watching a program on the history of this, and this thing really took off when Monday Night Football came with ABC because it brought NFL into mainstream Americana prime. You know what I'm saying, in the evening. So if Toyota had, do you remember in the late 80s when Honda had engines for McLaren, how many ads they would run here?
Yeah.
They were all run under the Acura brand, but they would show all these Formula cars. So Toyota can do the same thing. You know, they're promoting Toyota cars, but if millions and millions of people are seeing an American face in Europe, then, you know, some of them will take an interest.
Keep up the good work, Ness.
Speaking of Honda ads, they've been running a lot of motor racing ads lately. Funny how their Formula One car is conspicuously missing from those ads. But
that is so sad. But there you have it, gentlemen. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with Motorsports Mondial and all sorts of other goodies. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello, this is Andrew with this week's F1Weekly.com trivia question. Last weekend, the Indianapolis 500 was run, so I thought we'd have an Indy-related question. Five drivers have won both the F1 World Driver Championship and the Indianapolis 500 race. Can you name them? And I'll be back later in the show with the answer. Want to find out how much you know about Formula One? Are you interested in learning more about Formula One's history? Then have a listen to the Formula One Trivia Podcast, a weekly 10-question trivia quiz that will test your knowledge. Visit the website at www.f1triviapodcast.com to find out more.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Hello, people. Thank you for listening. Now we have an interview with Jan Magnussen from Denmark. I met him at Laguna Seca a few weeks ago. And this gentleman used to be in karting, world champion. Then he was in British Formula 3, very successful. And he was rated by none other than Mr. Jackie Stewart, or should I say Sir Jackie Stewart, as the next Ayrton Senna. Magnussen joined Stewart's Formula One team, and then things just did not work out for him. And I asked him what the problem was when he was with such a good mentor, Jackie Stewart. And it basically, you know, turns out he said what Max Pappas also said to me, who I'd also interviewed at the same weekend, that they wish they had good management and good advice early in their career. And in the case of Jan Magnussen, he really just, you know, came into Formula One very quickly, should have done some testing or, you know, be on the same program as Lewis Hamilton was, get groomed for the big league, because there's nothing like being prepared when you enter a big arena. And in Formula One, the way things are, they don't give you many chances. So he got kind of burned out, just like Max Pappas. I also got the impression that he got burnt out. But now he's doing a pretty decent job. He's competing in the Danish Touring Car Championship, doing very well, and also racing here in the United States in the Grand Am series. And his date of birth is pretty interesting. So I hope you enjoy this interview, and please send us some information, what you would like to hear when we talk to people. And we'll try to get as many questions from our listeners from other drivers. Now, here is Jan Magnussen from Denmark.
Okay, I'm here with Jan Magnussen from Denmark. And Jan, first of all, I think our American listeners should know your date of birth, and that will make you the most popular driver in America right away.
My date of birth is 4th of July, 1973.
Do you get special treatment at the airport?
No, not very much, but I've had my birthday out here a couple of times, and it's much more fun than being in Denmark.
Good. How popular is motor racing in Denmark, and what are the major tracks?
Motor racing is very popular in Denmark because we've had some good results for Danish drivers, latest with Tom Christensen's 7 Le Mans victories. So motorsport interest is very high. When I went to Formula One, it was a big gain in interest, and then since with Tom Christensen. Unfortunately, we don't have any big tracks in Denmark. We have only three small tracks, but Jyllandsringen is the major track.
Now, is this the track where Peter Revson's brother was killed?
I don't know my history well enough to do that, but I don't think so.
Okay, well, we can look into it. You were FIA karting champion in 1987, 88, and 1990. At what age did you start racing? And was there any interest in your family? How did you get interested in this?
Just the whole family was interested at that. I actually started doing motocross when I was very young, 6 years old. But I did go-karts from when I was 10. Then, like I said, I won the world championship in, three times, in 87, 89, and 90. The interest comes from the family, and my dad was always interested. My brother was my mechanic all through go-kart.
How many years were you in karting, and what is the most important thing a young kid learns in karting which helps him in or her in motor racing?
Well, I was in karting from 84 to 91, and the best thing you learn from go-karts is, the best thing is you start so young, so you learn a lot of stuff in regards to, you know, the technical side of it a little bit, but for me, most importantly, is the racecraft that you get from a very early age.
I was talking to Martin Hines, and I'm sure you know who that is, and yes. He said, you know, one of the most important things is learning how to win and learning how to lose. What other things can a kid learn or should learn, or what are the do's and don'ts when you are in karting?
Well, the thing is, when you start so young, you know, you have a chance to make a lot of mistakes without it being really expensive. But like I said, you know, the most important thing you take from go-karts is the racecraft. It's how to race and how to read a race situation.
How important to your career was winning the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch in 1992?
Very important because it was the first major victory for me in racing cars. At the time, I didn't have a lot of money, and it gave good interest from other teams, kind of pushed me on my way.
In 1994, you won the very competitive British Formula 3 Championship with 14 victories from 18 starts. What are your most memorable moments from that season?
Obviously, winning the championship. I did that at Silverstone. But it was also a very special moment for me when I was able to beat Senna's record. But the whole year was such a great experience because of so much success, and it felt like no matter what I did, I couldn't do anything wrong. So now I hope to have another season like that again.
You made your Grand Prix debut in 1995 at Ida in Japan for McLaren. How did you find the environment in Formula One? Is the pressure to perform much higher than other series?
Absolutely. My debut was very nice with McLaren. They all took care of me very, very well. And kept the pressure away from me the best they could. When I joined Formula One properly with the Stewart Grand Prix, the pressure was much higher to perform and was a really difficult time for me because it was a new team with lots of problems. You know, the pressure just built up and didn't really help me in the end.
Now, your fellow Scandinavian Kimi Raikkonen recently called Ron Dennis a control freak. Do you think he is right, or what is your assessment of Ron Dennis as a person?
I think Kimi is 100% right. He's a very hard person to work for, but I have to say he's one of the most impressive people I've ever worked for also. But it's hard, but that's how it is in Formula One.
Is he hard because he's very demanding, or he's just a jerk?
No, it's because he's very demanding. He demands you to be almost inhuman, and it's hard for some. It's hard for me.
Now, you answered my previous question about Jackie Stewart. How did you find Jackie Stewart as a person compared to Ron Dennis?
Jackie probably has more of a human side to him also. I never knew Ron the way that I knew Jackie back then. So it's hard to say with where the biggest differences are. That they're both super competitive and wants the best for their team and wants the best out of everybody around them. It's hard to really compare the two because I only knew Ron from sitting behind the desk.
Jackie Stewart rated you as the best Formula 3 driver ever, and then in 1998 you were dropped from the team before the season was over. Can you please tell your side of the story, what led to this?
Well, obviously, my performance wasn't good enough for the team, apparently, and I think lots of things didn't really help me. The first year was a struggle for me because it was my first year in Formula One. There was lots of problems. My teammate was Rubens Barrichello, who was very strong and knew exactly what he was doing, and I was kind of feeling my way around. When the second season started, there was big expectations that the new car was going to perform a lot better than the old one, which had some really great moments, the first car. So everybody thought the second car was going to be much better. Turned out it wasn't. There was a real dud. Actually, it broke even more than the first one. And I think because the expectations from Jackie's side to me, because of the Formula 3, were maybe too high for me to live up to.
You know, starting a new team is a real hassle. I mean, we see it in Toyota now. Looking back at your time in Formula 1, and especially with Stewart Racing, do you think it would have been better had you signed with the established team and avoiding the frustration of startup operation? Because, you know, if things are not working, they're going to blame the driver. How do you look back on that?
Oh, for sure. It was a mistake for me to sign with Stewart, but it was an offer to go and do Formula 1, and I wasn't going to turn that down, but... Sure, I've been thinking about what if I'd gone with a different team, there are less problems, maybe more support for me. It's all in the past. I can't change that anyway.
Who do you think will win the Formula One championship this year? And do you attend any Formula One races these days?
I don't attend any Formula One races. My own schedule is so busy, I don't have time. I hope that Kimi wins this year. He really deserves it, and I'm a big fan of him, but... I have to say, it's hard to not be a fan of Hamilton also. He's really impressed everybody.
I'm also actually hoping for Kimi, just because he's very quick and he deserves to win the championship. Let's see what happens. You have raced in Champ Cars also. Any thoughts how the Open Wheel Series in America could be reunited? And how much did you enjoy Champ Cars compared to your time in Formula One?
Well, I loved doing Champ Cars. I thought it was a great atmosphere to race in. Like the tracks that they went to. In the whole format, the car is fun to drive. It's a bit heavier than a Formula One car. Stops a little bit slower than a Formula One car. It's probably in many ways a better race car for the racing spectral side of it. Obviously, the Formula One car is a lot quicker. In terms of how the two open wheel series in America are going to reunite, I have no idea, and I don't think anybody else has. One of the parties have to back down completely and leave control in the other one's hands, and apparently that's a problem.
Do people in Europe follow American racing scene like Champ Cars, IRL, and especially NASCAR, which is so huge here?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially NASCAR is getting a big boost in Europe now. It's getting bigger and bigger. It used to be looked down upon by many people in Europe as NASCAR, they go around in circles. But it is a spectacle, and it's the biggest thing in America, you know, and it's spreading now, I think, fast into Europe. I think every race series in the world wish they have the success of NASCAR.
Your favorite tracks, both here in the U.S. and overseas?
Well, we're here right now. Laguna Seca is my favorite track in America, and my favorite track in Europe has to be Spa.
That's what almost everybody says.
Oh, the old Nürburgring, but I never raced there.
Your most memorable achievement in motor racing so far?
winning Le Mans with Corvette last 3 years.
Do you plan to be there this year also?
Yes, I'll be there in still with Corvette, but in the other car.
How much fun is Mulsanne at 2 in the morning?
It depends on your position, but it's great. I love Le Mans. I love the whole thing about Le Mans. I didn't always love it, but I've come to love it, and the whole thing is just a special place, you know. During the daytime, during the night, there's so many different aspects with all the people, and plus Le Mans is a place where up to 40,000 Danish people come and watch, so it's always special to run there.
Now, when you race here in the U.S., what part of America are you based in?
I used to be based in Georgia, but now just wherever the racing is, so I live in Denmark.
Thank you very much, Jan Magnussen.
Jan, thank you for your time, and wish you continued success in the business of motor racing. Thank you.
And here's this week's F1Weekly.com trivia answer. The five drivers who have won both the Formula One World Driver Championship and the Indianapolis 500 race are Graham Hill, who won Indy in 1966 and was the Formula One Driver Champion in 1962 and 1968. Jim Clark won Indy in 1965. And he was the driver champion in 1963 and 65. Emerson Fittipaldi, who won Indy twice in 1989 and 93, and was the Formula One driver champion also twice in 72 and 74. Mario Andretti won Indy in 1969, and was the Formula One World Driver Champion in 1978. And finally, Jacques Villeneuve, who won Indy in 1995 and was the Formula One Driver Champion in 1997. Okay, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next week. Bye now.
Hi, I'm David Coulthard, otherwise known as DC, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
This kind of podcast means only one thing: quality. The pinnacle of interviews. Nasser, introduce this former F1 driver.
Yes, sir. Thank you. This conversation was with Tiago Monteiro from Portugal, of course. And I really enjoyed this conversation. And, of course, his big moment in motor racing was the podium finish by him in the historic 2005 U.S. Grand Prix.
On Bridgestone tires.
Yes, all the finishers were on Bridgestone's tires.
Imagine.
Gee, I wonder why. But anyway, it was great talking to him. Enjoyed talking about his early days. He started racing in Porsche Cup. Actually, he grew up in France, and then kind of late comer to the racing. But when you have pure racing talent, you know, you can catch up to the competition. And some of us will remember he also raced here in Champ Cars. And he is currently driving still and still enjoying with same passion and determination in the World Touring Car Series with Seat, and also has Ocean Racing Technology in GP2, and they just also took on GP3 for the first time this year. So it was great talking to him, and I would like to thank him so much for his time, and also thanks to his PR lady, Miss Rute Vieira, for making this possible. So obrigado to both of them, and hope the listeners enjoy this conversation.
On the line today is Portuguese Grand Prix driver and GP2 team owner Tiago Monteiro. Tiago, welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
Great. I hope my first question will put a big smile on your face. June 19, 2005, man from Oporto on podium in Formula Uno. What do you remember most from that wonderful race at Indianapolis?
Wow, yeah, definitely. One of the craziest races ever, both for Formula One and for myself. Something, you know, definitely a very weird situation, but it was an opportunity, and I needed to be there to take it. It was such an important moment of my life and career. Some people liked it, some people didn't, but at the end of the day, you have to be there. And when you have an opportunity like this, well, you have to get it. I was still fighting with my opponent. My teammate, the Minardi guys, those are the guys I was fighting with all year long, you know. But usually we fight for 16, 17, 15 place. And that day we were able to fight for something a lot more important. So it was definitely important to be at the right place at the right time. And I'm glad it happened. So So, yeah, it was a very important day.
I was there, and I will never forget how excited you were when you got out of your car. were you aware when you got in your Jordan that Michelin cars will not race?
No. We were aware that some of the guys from Michelin might not race, some of the teams, or they would race, but they could stop at the pits, or they could maybe race, but by going through the pits every lap. There was many stories, many rumors all over the paddock. So we knew that there could be a chance of doing something good, scoring some points, have a good finish result. But we never expected that they would all of them stop. Never. Therefore, it was a big surprise when, on our way to the grid, we see all the cars in front of us going to the pit lane. And then I realized, oh my God, this is a lot more important and a lot more crazy than we expected. And the stakes are very, very high. So I definitely needed to finish in front of my opponents. That was the opportunity I needed to take, the most important one.
Great. Now, did you send some fine Oporto vino to Pierre de Pasquier?
No, I sent him a replica of my trophy.
Okay, that's good. Okay, your team owner, Mr. Jordan, has a very nice vocabulary. What was his reaction, and how did you find him as a team owner? Obviously, very different from Trevor Carlin, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, Eddie Jordan was only there for a few months when I joined the team. He was actually not in the USA when this happened. So, of course, he was excited. Of course, it was a interesting moment for him as well, but he was not there. And he was not part of the team anymore at that time.
Okay, good. Moving forward to 2012 season, you have Nigel Melker from Netherlands in your GP2, and he has quite a bit of experience and success. What are your expectations from him and his teammate?
Well, Nigel is one of the most promising talents at the moment. Still a young guy, 20 years old, with already quite a good experience for sure. Not so much in GP2 yet, but in other series. Really fast, really clever, really hard worker. So we're very excited and very happy to have him on board. We did some good testing the last few days in Jerez. Now we're going to Barcelona next week, and we're trying to prepare him as best as possible for the beginning of the season. So when you have rookies on board, GP2 is such a tough competitive championship that it's always difficult, but we need to prepare them as much as possible and give them the most confidence, as much confidence as possible.
Okay, your team cars, they have a very nice blue paint scheme, blue and black. A question I have, your team is called Ocean Racing Technology. Is that because you're located near the sea or because of the Portuguese passion for high seas?
it's a little bit of a mix. We were looking at the name. I was never a big fan of having my name as a team name, like some other people do. I mean, I got no problem about it. Jordan does it, did it. Williams, Carlin as well. But I don't
Ferrari
know.
Ferrari
also, of course. But I never really saw that way. And I always thought that if one day I had a team, I didn't really want it to call my name. Well, that's just a personal, personal
sure.
decision. And then we were looking with our PR company, we're looking at the different names, and I wanted something a bit different as well and stuff. And then when you look at the Portuguese story, we conquered the world a long time ago by the ocean, basically. We were very strong on the ocean, and we are still in front of the ocean, obviously. And so there was many reasons why we wanted to be called Ocean. And, we conquered a lot of countries 60, 100 years ago. We also want to conquer the racing world right now. So that was the reason behind it, basically.
Well, very good name. I like that.
Thanks.
Among the talent you have seen in GP2 past few seasons, who has impressed you among the drivers?
Not easy, but I think, definitely Nigel Melker is very impressive. Antonio Felix da Costa was very impressive. Alvaro Parente, Brandon Hartley, very impressive. You know, all of them, when you sign them, is because you think they are good, right? So I like all of them. Some we had better experiences than others, for sure. That's life. That's racing. But all the guys that I signed for my team, it was guys that I trusted and I believed they could do a good job.
Now, you mentioned you had some experiences that were good, some were not so good. Since you have brought this up, let me ask you a question. When you have an experience which is not good, I'm sure it's more than just not good results. Maybe how the driver behaves or how he trusts the team or does not trust the team.
There can be many things. I mean, we could be at fault because, I mean, every team has a mentality, has a structure, has an experience, right? And some drivers just don't fit with that. Sometimes it happens. So the feeling, the relationship doesn't work out, for example. Then you can also have a driver that doesn't suit the driving style of our car. You know, every team has a kind of a setup, and some drivers can use it and be very fast right away. Some very good drivers don't like it, and they can't be fast with it. So that's another reason why sometimes things don't go well. And then sometimes you have drivers that have that they arrive to GP2 and they think they already know everything, you know, and they never put themselves into a question. And they think that if they arrive here, it's because they're good and they know, and they don't realize that they're still very young and very raw talent, you know, and they still need to work. Even when you reach Formula One, and that's, you know, that's what I try to explain to them, that even a Sebastian Vettel, even an Alonso, even a Hamilton, all those guys are still learning. Every day they learn. Every day they put themselves in on the spot and they try to evolve. They try to question mark everything that they do to try to evolve. If you stop doing that, well, the other guys are going to go faster than you and they're going to be better than you. And whether you are in GP2, in Formula One, in go-kart, that's the most important thing. First, you need to put yourself into question. And then when you've done that, which is never ends really, then you can start asking all the questions. But it's very important to be to accept that no matter how good you are, you can always improve somewhere. You always need to learn more, and you always need to be a better driver in general, total.
Yeah, that's the same in racing and also in life, always room to learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now two drivers I want to name, they are from this side of the pond. One of them raced with you. How would you rate these two drivers, Alexander Rossi, who had done some races with you, and Esteban Gutierrez of Mexico?
Well, obviously for Alex Rossi, I can say that, you know, as you said, he raced for us. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy, very clever, very fast, very motivated, good mentality with the team. He's one of the top, top guys out there, you know. I wish he had the good opportunity because he really deserves it. He's a hard worker. He improved a lot as a driver, physically, mentally. You know, he's one of the true professionals that I know for his young generation, basically. Esteban, I know him, obviously, and I spoke to him many times, and he's in a team that I know very well, which is ART. But I've never worked with him, so he's obviously a great talent, there's no doubt about it, a lot of speed in him, but I cannot say anything about his personality or anything, because, like I said, I've never worked with him directly.
Okay, great. Now we have some questions about Thiago Monteiro, the race car driver. The 1997 French Porsche Carrera Cup was your first foray into racing. Was the lack of karting or junior-level single-seater experience a problem for you?
Yes. Yeah, I can say it was an issue. Sure, when you compare, you know, when you had no experience in motorsports, no matter how much talent you have to start with, you're always going to struggle against some guys that have already done like 5, 6, 10 years experience. That's no doubt about it. So I can say I was lucky to be fast from the beginning, but I was lacking a lot of things. I was lacking racing craft. I was lacking mentality in terms of managing the races, managing the overtakings. I had no idea what we were talking about. So it was very tough initially, for sure. But things went quite well. So I cannot complain too much. But it was definitely a harder step for me as a driver to start that light and to start in a series with so many professional guys already.
And Checo, since you started late, was it because there was no interest in your family in motorsports, or were you involved in some other sporting activities?
There was those two things. Although my father was a big fan of motorsports, he himself raced a long time ago. I wasn't even born. But he was a very busy man. He was working hard and working even on weekends. And so he had no time to take me to go-karts or whatsoever. And I was living in France at the time. We had no other family there. So I didn't have an uncle or a cousin or whoever that could take me to go-karts, you know, like sometimes happens. So I didn't have any other opportunities. And that's it. That's one of the reasons. So I never really realized that I liked that so much and I had the talent for that. So I was a lot more into motorbikes, actually, which was easier, you know, for me. I could take my motocross and leave home and go somewhere in a park or in a forest or whatever and just have fun. But go-karts was a lot harder for me to get and to reach. You know. And the other reason that I started to study hotel management, and there was no way my father was going to help me towards motorsports or put me in contact or whatever until I finished my degree. So that's why another reason why it took so long.
Okay. Now, you won 5 races. Were you surprised being Rookie of the Year?
Definitely. Yeah. It was nobody expected it, neither I, to be honest, because I didn't know what to expect, to be honest. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what to overtake. I didn't know how to qualify, but things in the end went quite well. It took a few races to start, but after a few races, I was in the rhythm and I was strong enough to fight for the good points, races, podiums, etc.
Now, following year 1998, you raced again in France, and this time you were Rookie of the Year in Formula 3. At this stage of your career, what did you enjoy more, single-seaters or tin-tops? Or what were your goals and hopes because you were just winning right off the bat?
I like both, actually. A few people asked me that, but I never know really what to expect. I don't know how to explain. It's such a different world, you know, single-seaters or prototypes or tin-tops. It's very different, and I have fun in both of them, you know. I really enjoy myself in both of them, and I could not say which one I prefer. Maybe Formula One is different because it's the extreme power, extreme efficiency, extreme technology. You can't compare to anything else. But if you take even a champ car or another strong series in single seaters, I cannot say which one I prefer the most. If it's touring cars, GTs, or single seaters. As long as there's four tires, a steering wheel, lots of power, and goes fast, I'm happy.
Great. Now, following season 1999, you race at Le Mans. How was that experience, and what's it like going at Mulsanne flat out after midnight?
It's impressive. It's really incredible. Very hard to explain, but that's why Le Mans is such an amazing experience, human experience, but also personal experience that I love. And one of the reasons is that you have so many crazy moments, you know, and be so fast at night in Lausanne, all those S Porsches and all these areas there. I really love it. It's a very strong feeling for sure.
In the year 2000, you were second in the French Formula 3 with 4 wins. What were the high points and memorable races for you from that season?
Well, I think my time in Formula 3 was a very strong learning process for single seaters. I didn't do any single seaters before doing Formula 3. Therefore, I had to learn everything already in Formula 3. So I enjoyed my time there. I had a great time, won many races. But the most important one that I won was definitely Spa in the British Championship. We were in the French Championship. We just did one off event in Belgium, in Spa, but it was part of the British Championship with all the guys like Button, Carty Cayenne, Pizzonia, Bernoulli. All those guys were there. And we arrived there from the French Championship, different tires, and I won the race. it was really one of the most important races I've won for sure in my career. And then, of course, second in Korea with Kartik Ayan, it was also important. And winning in pole, winning some races were important, but I can't. Yeah, if I have to pinpoint one, I would say Spa.
That's the place to win.
Yeah.
Okay. In 2002, you tested a Formula One machine for the first time. Was that the most exciting racing experience you've had at that time? By that time?
Wow. Yeah. It was definitely one of the most impressive moments of my career. 2002 Barcelona with the Renault team. I was still young. It was an amazing moment of my life. I loved it. I took the best of it, you know, and I will never forget that moment for sure.
Now, you were also part of the Renault Driver Development Program. How did that deal come about? And I sure would like to get your comments on Signor Flavio Briatore.
It was a great opportunity for me. Again, I've learned a lot with all of them, both personally, personally, physically, mentally. I've learned a lot. I evolved a lot as a driver. And I will never forget the fact that they gave me my first F1 opportunity. And Mr. Briatore was always a strong help there, a strong motivator. As you know, he has his own way of dealing with things. You know, you can either like it or not, but he's definitely a motivator and a hard worker.
So your experience with him was positive?
Okay,
that's good. In 2004, you were second only to Heikki Kovalainen in the World Series by Renault. Now we are in a very different financial situation, but back then, how much financial support you had from Portuguese companies to break into Formula One and keep on going with your racing career?
Quite strong, actually. The whole country was behind me, you know. The whole government, several national companies were behind me. I was very fortunate to have this support. You know, my career exploded in 2002, yes, with that first F1 test. And then Champ Car, and then a great season in the World Series in 2004. And everything came into play. There was a good timing for everything. The great results with Trevor Carlin, and then he moved to Jordan. Therefore, I had those opportunities. And I have to say, very difficult to replicate that because, you know, you have to be at the right time, at the right moment, at the right place. And that only happens once in a lifetime, for sure.
Okay. Your country has also produced other racing talent like Felipe Albuquerque, Alvaro Parent, and Antonio Felix da Costa. Based on your experience, both as a successful driver and now team owner, what is the missing link or what can be done so this kind of talent can get into and succeed in Formula One?
Well, they have to do a very good work on track. There's no doubt about it. They have to keep up the good work they're doing on track. And then the management behind them have to do a good work behind the doors, you know, behind the racing, basically, you know. You have to have the right contacts, the right people behind you, and know the right people. So it's not easy. The actual economic situation of Europe and Portugal is very critical. So the times are tough. It's never been easy, but I think it's definitely harder right now.
Okay, great. Now, you have raced here in the U.S. also, starting from pole position in the Lamborghini Super Trophy at Laguna Seca. What was your impression of this track, especially the corkscrew? And we are not too far from this track, by the way.
I mean, I love it. It was my first time there. Pole position with the Lamborghini was a great experience. The track is just wonderful. It has so much history, you know. I've heard about it so much. I've seen it on TV so much. When you get there, you know, it's so different, so specific with this corkscrew and many other places. So I love it. It was an amazing experience. I love that race. I love that track. Then I went there again in Champ Car. It was really, really good. So, place I really like.
Yeah, you mentioned Champ Cars where you raced in 2003. You had pole for the Mexican race. What were other highs and lows of the season for you? And how did you get into Champ Cars? What was behind this?
First, how I got there was really because Chris Pook at the time, president of the series, was looking to come into Europe, right? And he was looking to come into different places like Portugal and England, Germany and stuff. And he was looking for some young European drivers to bring over there. And we got in touch by some common friends or common people that we knew, and he invited me to go and see one or two races, which I did. Very quickly, we came to a great deal. You know, he had some budget where he could help some young drivers, and he did help me and Darren Manning at the time, if you remember. And then there was also a good coincidence that Emerson Fittipaldi was putting up this new team, and you know, we also met, and we got along very quickly. And in 2 weeks, basically, the deal was done. It was a very, very good situation. That's basically how it happened.
And who were the drivers?
Oh, yeah. But the other part of the question was, best moments were definitely, of course, top position in Mexico was amazing. But I led a few races, and actually led my first race in San Pedro.
Okay, great. So you were telling me about the highlights of the Champ Car career here in 2003?
Yeah, so then I was saying that even though we only had the off-a-day testing before the first race, I was still able to lead on the first race of my career in Champ Car, which was a great experience. Pole position was also a great experience there, and I had a lot of great moments. A tough year, obviously, with a very small team. Very limited funding, but in the end, I really love it.
And what drivers in Champ Cars impressed you?
Well, Bourdais was obviously very strong at the time. I knew him very well. He had been my teammate in the past, but he was very strong with Newman at the time. And then Paul Tracy was great, very strong also, you know. Yeah, those two were strong.
You mentioned two very interesting names, and they were, you know, at each other's throat. Whose side were you on, Bourdais or Tracy?
None. I'm friends with both, and so I was with both of them.
Okay, great. Now, you know, I enjoy watching you driving a Seat in the World Touring Car Championship. Now that you are a team owner and also racing, is the desire, passion, and the will to win is the same as when you first started in the Porsche Cup?
Oh, it's more than ever. You know, every time you grow, every time you go up in your career, you want more and more, and that's what I really do want. I really do want more and more wins and results. So I fight harder for everything. And I think I'm a lot more thirsty for win and for results than I was back then. You know, I'm a lot more aggressive, a lot more demanding with everything, more professional. So, yeah, definitely more than other time.
And in your racing life, what is your favorite track and what city do you enjoy visiting most?
Favorite track would have to be Spa, Laguna Seca, maybe also in Macau.
Oh, interesting. Okay, now your thoughts on the new F1 cars. Most of them are calling them ugly. How do you like the design of new cars, and what do you think will happen in Albert Park?
That's a very difficult one to say, to be honest. I'm struggling to read into the testing times, which is impossible. So right now, I haven't had really a strong opinion on how things going to happen. Yeah, for sure, the design is not very nice. The cars are getting, uglier and uglier, actually. But that's life, you know. You get used to it every time anyway.
Yeah.
But in terms of who's going to be stronger, I'm sure McLaren will be strong. I'm sure Red Bull and Ferrari will be strong still. But it seems to be a lot of competition out there.
And going back to your series, GP2, I'm sure you would like to see Melker or the other driver win. Who do you think will be GP2 champion this year?
It has to go, probably, most certainly, will go to one of the most experienced guys, you know. I mean, you got Bassecchi with four years. You got Van der Garde with 4 or 5 years. You got Close. You got Limer, Kral, they already had 3 years. All those guys have such a huge experience that they're going to be strong contenders. I would go for one of those.
Now, Thiago, really appreciate your time. Finally, will you please tell our listeners, we have listeners all over the world, including your country, a little bit about Thiago Monteiro, the man, not the driver and team owner. What kind of music do you like? What's your taste in food and, you know, stuff like that?
I'm a very easygoing person. You know, I like most of the regular things. You know, I like extreme sports. I like regular sports. I don't like football. I like all kind of music. Depends on what kind of mood I am in, you know, from classical to hard rock to techno to pop to everything, you know, depends on what kind of mood I am. You know, I'm a family man. I love my kids. I love my wife, and I like to travel. I'm not too complicated, I think. And I love my fans, which are great, and live without them for sure.
Well, that's very nice. And talking of family, if I may ask, your kids, are they showing any interest in motorsports?
Yeah, well, they're 4 and 2, but both of them are very keen and they love cars and they love motorsports and they love sports in general, skateboarding and bicycle, all this.
Great. Okay, Tiago, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And
thank
have you. A pleasant evening.
All right. Thank you. You too. Take care. Okay.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Tiago, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. We want to thank Andrew McPhee of F1 Trivia Podcast for providing this week's trivia. Keep up the good work, Andy, and I certainly hope you're feeling much better now. And of course, this is the email segment with my co-host, Steve Falb. Steve?
Hey, Clark. First email this week is from Ken in Tucson, and he writes about the name change. Hi, great podcast you have. Sorry to hear about Bernie pushing you around. Maybe you should just call it Not Bernie's F1Weekly.com. That should get him off your back. Replace your logo with a picture of Bernie covered by the international no symbol. But by all means, keep up the good work, no matter what you call it. You are the best of the bunch. You are the top dog, king of the hill, number one, da man. No, wait, that's Bernie. Thanks anyway for a great podcast. Love those interviews. Love Desiree Ken in Tucson.
Man, my head is just not going to fit through that front
exactly.
door today.
We're not going to be able to get out the door today. And our next one is from Patrick. And Patrick writes, Ron Dennis. Good evening, Clark. I was just wondering if you had caught the look on the face of Ron Dennis at the awarding of the trophies in Monaco. What a puss. Would it kill him to smile? His drivers absolutely slaughtered the entire field, lapping everyone in sight but Massa. And being a full minute plus on him. And it's still not enough. What's it going to take for him to grin? Being the only cars left in the race? Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. To all, Patrick in Seaford, New York.
Okay, the truth is, I found out through the grapevine that Ron Dennis has an ingrown toenail.
Oh, so he's in pain. So he's not in a smiley mood.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Stephen. Keep up the good work. Bob, Fred. And Stephen, good night.
Good night.
I say Liuzzi, he says Luisi. I say Patrese, he says Patrici. Patrese, Patrici, Liuzzi, Luisi. Let's call the whole thing off.